Again, thank you for sticking around for panel three. We've got an excellent panel for you this afternoon. I'm Bill Lay. I'm the Deputy CIO for Information Assurance and the Chief Information Security Officer for the U.S. Department of State. I'm focused primarily on internal cyber issues, and we're doing all we can to make sure that the mission of foreign affairs continues, providing that our IT systems, infrastructure, especially our information, is protected, not compromised, and integrity is there. To my right, I've got Michelle Markoff. She is the Deputy Coordinator for Cyber Issues at the U.S. Department of State. And I've got Colonel John Brickley. He's the with the Army Cyber Institute, the National Capital Region Liaison for the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. And then John Keon from the, he's the Vice Chairman of the Board for the Flynn Intel Group. And with not further ado, I'll let Michelle lead off.
Thank you very much, and I want to thank the organizers for inviting me to be here, and I'm going to talk about probably a different set of issues than you've heard about so far today, and my remit is how we reduce cyber risk using diplomacy as opposed to defending our networks. And you know, while we all acknowledge that the private sector owns 90% of the infrastructure that carries network activity, states have a very important role to play with regard to reducing risks and maintaining international peace and stability among all nations in cyberspace. But rather than trying to regulate or control it, the U.S. has viewed the role of states as one of many stewards, that is, a caretaker who will work with all other stakeholders to ensure that the internet and the networks is a resource that are available to all who want to reap its positive rewards and benefits. And it's this inclusive concept that forms the basis for the multi-stakeholder process and reflects the reality of how the internet actually functions today. As been pointed out repeatedly, we're all increasingly dependent on networked information systems for the daily functioning of our societies. And with that dependency has come increasing vulnerabilities whose disruption can now affect whole populations through threats to critical networks and cyber-enabled infrastructures. And these threats, we all agree, are increasingly perceived as fundamental threats to national security. And it's in this arena of potential large-scale threats to national security from either other states or non-state actors and criminals where states have a historical and an important role to play. And it's here that nations must facilitate transnational cooperation, and here that we must be peacekeepers by reducing the risk to cyberspace through diplomacy. Several years ago, we concluded that in order to keep the peace in cyberspace, the international community needed to strive for a state of international cyber stability, which we defined as a more peaceful environment where all states are able to positively exploit the benefits of cyberspace, where there are benefits to cooperation and to avoiding conflict, and little incentive for states to disrupt or attack one another. But how do you achieve that? It was clear that due to the unique attributes of cyberspace, multiple actors, lack of high-confidence attribution of identity or sponsorship of perpetrators, the usability of tools across a range of conflict and low lethality, and the dual-use nature of information technology, the strategies that stood us well throughout the Cold War, such as arms control-like negotiated limits on military applications of information technologies, were really not realistic. Nor, for the same reasons, did we think it possible to establish the conditions necessary to achieve meaningful deterrence of an adversary in cyberspace. We did conclude that we needed stronger, more resilient defenses, improved attribution of the origin of attacks, credible response options, and clear declaratory policy, And lastly, increased international engagement to promote norms of responsible state behavior, to create a consensus among like-minded states about what is appropriate state-on-state behavior in cyberspace. In order to develop an international framework for a technology which has no external observables, it can't be seen, can't be counted, and where state capabilities cannot easily be assessed, we need to develop some confidence that normal operating behavior by states is somewhat predictable. Otherwise, any activity in cyberspace could cause unintended reactions, miscalculation, or misattribution, thus increasing the risk of unintended conflict. Our view has been that the framework of existing international legal norms, such as international humanitarian law and the UN Charter, which guides states in their use of kinetic military tools, is, in other contexts, also applies to cyberspace. Subscribing to international law means that the same care that goes into planning and targeting of kinetic weapons would be required for cyberspace, that civilian infrastructures would not be legitimate targets, that care had to be taken with respect to collateral damage, and that the rules of proportionality and distinction would also apply. We also believe that since much cyber activity can fall below the threshold of the use of force, the law of countermeasures would also apply. But we also concluded that norms alone were not enough. We needed to repurpose the concept of practical transparency and confidence-building measures in order to build trust and confidence and competence to reduce the risk of misperception and instability, and eventually to allow us to cooperate against those who choose to disrupt networks and information systems. In sum, our view was that cyberspace stability should be our goal in large part to be achieved and maintained not by mutual deterrence through network hostage taking with threats of destruction, although credible retaliatory response options have to be part of the mix of military options, but by affirming or establishing norms of existing international law and by providing incentives of shared benefit and reducing incentives for conflict by building confidence through these practical confidence and stability measures. These CBMs play an important role. The uncertainty regarding military activities of states with regard to a technology that cannot be seen is highly destabilizing in and of itself. If you don't know the size, capability, or posture of forces, or even when an attack may emanate from a particular state, a nationally significant cyber attack may leave you in one of two undesirable positions if you need to respond in real time. You are either paralyzed or you lash out blindly, and neither option, I venture, is desirable. In the area of CBMs, we saw a variety of practical measures that states could take cooperatively, and these fall loosely into three areas. Transparency measures, which give greater predictability and clarity to state intentions. This means publishing doctrines, rules of engagement, even force structure, all toward the end of reducing the probability that state activities might be misconstrued. Cooperative measures that would allow like-minded states to work together against common threats, even to address specific cyber problems of concern, such as botnet zero-day exploits or threats to civilian critical infrastructures. Effective cooperation against common but discrete threats over time could build confidence that more demanding threats could be addressed, and such cooperation would build processes and mechanisms that could be replicated for other purposes. Lastly, confidence in security building. If cooperative actions aimed at certain threats themselves prove useful, then states can form what we would call a self-selected voluntary community of responsibility to define state activities that are inherently destabilizing and which they can pledge to refrain from. A useful analogy here would be the 1972 U.S.-Soviet Incidents at Sea Agreement, which was negotiated to stop practices that frequently led to confrontation on the high seas. One might imagine a cyber equivalent. Other measures designed to address potential instabilities might be conceived where self-restraint is involved. And to the extent that they're useful, they'll build confidence over time. This process of norms and confidence-building measures has provided a basis for some success internationally. In June of 2013, in the context of a UN group of governmental experts on information security, to which I was the US representative, 15 states achieved a groundbreaking consensus report which affirmed key norms. And these states included Russia, China, India, Indonesia, Australia, Canada, Japan, and other European allies. The norms that they affirmed included the application of norms derived from existing international law relevant to the use of information and communication technologies by states is an essential measure to reduce risk to international peace, security, and stability. International law, and in particular the Charter of the United Nations, is applicable and is essential to maintaining peace and stability and promoting an open, secure, peaceful, and accessible ICT environment. State efforts to address the security of ICTs must go hand in hand with respect for human rights and fundamental freedoms set forth in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other international instruments. States must meet their international obligations regarding internationally wrongful acts attributable to them, and states must not use proxies to commit internationally wrongful acts. States should also ensure that their territories are not used by non-state actors for unlawful use of ICTs. On the role of confidence-building measures, the UNGGE had a lot to say. Including that voluntary confidence-building measures can promote trust and assurance among states and help reduce the risk of conflict by increasing predictability and reducing misperceptions, and they can make an important contribution to addressing the concerns of states over the use of ICTs and could be a significant step toward greater international security. The report then detailed a long list of categories of confidence-building measures which member states, UN member states, could take, undertake. Of similar significance was the adoption by the Organization for Security Cooperation in Europe in 2013 of 9 substantive CBMs which had been under negotiation for 2 years and paralleled the work of the GGE based on its recommendations of its report. And then lastly, I would point out that in June of this year, we achieved with 20 states a document, a GGE consensus report, affirming what we call peacetime norms. These norms, which were not rooted in international law, were developed as the result of my Chinese and Russian counterparts pontificating endlessly about how the law of armed conflict, the threshold for the use of force was too high to deal with the majority of everyday cyber activities that plague us, and that we needed a set of rules to apply to the spectrum of activities falling below the threshold of the use of force. So we came up with, we took 2 years to come up with three norms we thought would be universally desirable, and then one President Obama came up with by himself. These included that a state should not conduct or knowingly support online activity that intentionally damages critical infrastructure or otherwise impairs the use of critical infrastructure to provide services to the public. A state should not conduct or knowingly support activity intended to prevent national computer security incident response teams from responding to cyber incidents. And a state should not use its computer security incident response teams to enable online activity that's intended to do harm. and that a state should cooperate in a manner consistent with its domestic law and international obligations with requests for assistance from other states in investigating cyber crimes, collecting electronic evidence, and mitigating malicious cyber activity emanating from its territory. And lastly, what the president has said repeatedly, particularly to the Chinese, that a state should not conduct or knowingly support cyber-enabled theft of intellectual property, including trade secrets or other confidential business information, with the intent of providing competitive advantage to its companies or commercial sectors. In addition, this recent GGE also agreed that states should not proliferate malicious technology or undermine the supply chain with hidden functions. I would just wrap up by stating that there are those who would say that given Chinese and Russian behavior, why should we put any confidence in the ability of norms to constrain them? Indeed, a blurb of a new book crossed my desk this morning announcing that norms are unlikely to deter China and Russia, and that other norms have certainly not constrained them from other exploits. And I certainly agree. But what the author and others miss is that the norms are not for the disruptors, per se, the bad guys. The norms are for the vast majority of peaceful states who will rally around them and agree when the acceptable line, or when the line of acceptable behavior has been crossed, and may permit us at some time in the future to organize to take actions against disruptors or rogue states. I'll stop there.
So, all right, thank you.
Okay.
Colonel Brickey.
Okay, well, the I guess the disadvantage or advantage, however you look at it, of being the last military person up here is that we don't need the first page anymore. We've talked about that. Most of the second page. No, I'll just start off saying I'm with the Army Cyber Institute at West Point. We're a fairly new think tank. We work with, are any of the military folks still in here? I don't think so. As General Yi was mentioning, there's kind of a triangle of support here. We have the Operational Command, which is Army Cyber Command, that's down here for Belvoir. We have the Institutional Training and Doctrine side of the house, and that is the Army Cyber Center of Excellence down at Fort Gordon, Georgia. And then we have, at West Point, we have a think tank, and that's the Army Cyber Institute. So that's where I am. I've worked with, I was with Army Cyber Command in the past. I've been with NSA, I've been with U.S. Cyber Command, Army Central Command, and U.S. Northern Command, and one other command out there, dealing with cyber issues in various capacities. What I really wanted to just jump into is just saying, if you look at our national security strategy, the most current one includes one small section on cyberspace. And really, it's about defending. General Yi mentioned that we do offensive operations, defensive operations, and then DODIN operations. That's defense of our own networks. But in the national security strategy, there's one little blurb that basically says we'll defend ourselves consistent with U.S. and international law against cyber attacks and impose costs on malicious cyber actors, including through prosecution of illegal cyber activity. That's it. There's nothing about offensive in there. Well, in my opinion, prosecution only works when you have the jurisdiction and reach, and it's not working so well for cyber. Additionally, across the board, as the Admiral mentioned earlier, we've not raised the cost to our adversaries. We've done a lot of talking about it, but we just haven't got there yet. The simple fact is that the cost to attack is much, much less than the cost to defend. We could basically spend ourselves out of this race, sort of like the Soviets did in the Cold War. Until we reverse the equation, then we'll struggle to instill confidence in the public and make them feel secure on the internet. The new DoD strategy, this is the DoD strategy for cyberspace, describes how the DoD fits into this cost equation and how it will fulfill deterrence responsibilities effectively. And unlike the 2011 DoD strategy for operating in cyberspace, the 2015 strategy actually addresses offensive cyber capabilities. That's a shift. And I believe the Admiral covered most of the, some of the things she covered with U.S. Cyber Command really addressed the strategy's strategic goals. And one out of the five goals that I wanted to point out was the fourth one, which is build and maintain viable cyber options and plan to use those options to control conflict escalation and to shape the conflict environment at all stages. So it's the Department of Defense's responsibility to provide options, including both flexible deterrent options, to the president that we can use as among a range of tools in conflict or even pre-conflict. So there's a lot of analogies. Actually, you brought up an analogy just a moment ago with you talking about the Navy agreement or agreement of the seas. There's actually a book on cyber analogies out there, and I couldn't find the one that I came across. So earlier in May of this year, the U.S. announced that it was going to accompany U.S. flagged merchant ships through the Strait of Hormuz. We've done this kind of thing before, a Navy escort. Recent history, we did it off the coast of Somalia, for example. And going back to World War II, Navy escorts were common and necessary to protect U.S. merchant ships, right? Those that are were transversing, in some cases, normal commerce, in some cases, war supplies to our allies. So this led me to think that maybe we should have a policy, this is just one of many out there, on cyber escorts. These would be limited duration to protect key cyber terrain and to demonstrate our capabilities to our adversaries and serve as a deterrent. The concept of the this concept in a protected industry is easy to understand in the normal physical domains, especially the maritime domain, but it's a lot more complex when you get into cyber. Lots of questions, and if you're into the technical details, you could go on forever about how it would actually work. But if this happened in the physical domain, if you take the attacks, loosely, because as I think we talked about earlier, there's very formal definitions of attacks in international law and use of force. But what we see, common attacks, whether it's target, OPM, whatever they may be, if we had comparable attacks in the physical domain, you wouldn't see the U.S. Taking it, with our hands tied behind our backs. You would see much more a hawkish response, I think. So, for example, if we had a maritime missile shot off the coast of New Jersey, hit a business, you would see a response rather quickly. A cyber escort policy would require close coordination with the private sector, especially with the companies, the telecoms, the companies that provide the infrastructure, the capabilities and capacities. So this is just one idea I had that I'm trying to write up and get published now, but there are a lot more out there, a lot better ideas, and we need to leverage those innovative minds out there. So that's what we seek to do in the Army Cyber Institute, is work with them, whether they're in industry, academia, or civil society, to address these key challenges. One thing I wanted to mention that earlier we got into talking about participation, cooperation with industry and others. If you're not familiar with this, the Department of Defense began a program just recently called the Defense Innovation Unit Experimental, or DIUX. They're currently standing up the first branch of that out in Silicon Valley. It kind of makes sense. This could expand later on to like Boston and the North Carolina Research Triangle Research Park. But what they'll do is they'll help to cultivate and facilitate a lasting relationship with these new innovators and those who don't always work with government, don't know how to work with the DoD especially, and help expand its innovative ecosystem of ideas. Now, DHS is doing this as well, and I'm not sure if other agencies are doing it, but I know the DoD and DHS are heavily involved in this right now. So their mission will be to strengthen existing relationships and build new ones, to scout for breakthrough in emerging technologies, and I'll also say to scout for the talent, which is really going to be difficult to convince someone in Silicon Valley to come work for us. But I think if it's a limited duration and we have industry support, maybe even subsidies from industry, that we should be able to make that happen. That would be a huge victory for us to get some of those folks in, not just for the ideas that they have, but the impact they would have on others and change the way we think. They would also serve as a local point of presence for Department of Defense. So oftentimes, industry folks come to me and they ask, where do I go in the Army or within Department of Defense? Because we have this great product, or we have these ideas, or we want to do these things. And so this would provide an avenue for them. So the Army Cyber Institute at West Point, we're supporting the Army's contribution to that organization and look forward to working with them. One thing I did want to say there is that going back, to the Conficker incident back in 2009, it wasn't the U.S. government that solved that problem. It was private sector. It was individuals, mostly researchers. So we understand that that's where the intellectual capital is and that we have to work with them and that we want to work with them. Thanks.
Thank you. Bijon?
Great. Well, I'm real pleased to hear the State Department's views and our military's because this is really what I want to say. A couple of things is in the arena of cyber environment, all of these forces have to come together. I don't see a possibility we're building shields and firewalls and doing things, all things cyber, is going to reduce the risk. As Colonel Bricky said, it takes a lot of effort, a lot of resources to build a countermeasure, and then technology moves faster. And as we develop policy and take our time to be able to have a system in place, the system in place becomes obsolete before we start implementing it. So I see definitely a need for all of the powers of the government in terms of diplomacy and formulation. You talked about the military escorts. From my perspective, I see the risk increasing in a number of ways. The population of the world is growing. There's a little dispute about whether it's going to be 9 billion or 10 billion, but there's no dispute on the fact that there's not going to be enough food and water for everybody in that world of the future. And there's little dispute that unstable governments are going to increase in numbers. And there's little dispute that, on the other hand, what doubles the challenge is that technology is growing very fast, and solutions that we think about in terms of technology alone are not going to move fast enough to be able to provide us with a shield. When it comes to building cooperation, I believe it's important to build that cooperation between private sector, especially military. There's a lot of productive exchange that can take place. In my day job, I am experiencing this sort of cooperation and technology integration and innovation, and I can see that there is a need to expand that. I served a couple years at the Naval Postgraduate School, and there the talk was to, you know, focus on creating a cyber National Guard, perhaps along the lines of what you were talking about, because if we have 1,500 or 2,000 cyber events across the country in any given period of time, it could happen in a matter of hours. We just don't have the resources to be able to attend to remedial action in reasonable good time. So there's a serious need to do that. As far as the cooperation is concerned, I also see a need to increase cooperation with law enforcement. I think it's important to be able to connect. I think every cop knows that without a community policing program, they will have a problem doing their job. Community policing is a known requirement in keeping society safe, especially as we move into a future that we see more cities, more population density, and the problems increase. I was just talking to a colonel in the other room that, you know, I travel all over the world, and I see a very effective implementation of see something, say something policies in the physical world. And it works because the community is involved. And I believe there is a need in the cyber environment to find ways to have the means to first see something and then say something. Now, what you see and who you're gonna say something, it's as part of that system that needs to be developed. The reality is going to be economic inequality. At the core of conflict is going to be there isn't enough resources for everybody to go around. There's going to be people with less hope in some places than others. When hope goes down, value for life goes down. When value for life goes down, it becomes very difficult to use other means other than perhaps coercive. Now, I'm not saying that solves the problem, that exacerbates the problem, but unfortunately there aren't that many choices. The reality doesn't leave us with 25 years to be able to take our time and correct a very, very deep economic issue. But it's a serious one. And when I come to this, I also see that as we look at the threats, of all kinds of threats, including insider threat, that makes it very difficult to manage the cyber environment. I'm reminded that, you know, when I was an economics student 36 years ago, our professors would teach us that factors of production are made out of land, labor, capital, and entrepreneurial spirit. And I've been asking the question, you know, if it's true that we've gone from agricultural age to industrial age and now in the information age, can we really seriously call land, labor, capital factors of production when we know that what's on the surface of the earth is not as important as what's up there in the space and frequency as the new land, maybe. When we look at labor, we see this machine called Baxter. Baxter watches YouTube and learns how to do assembly and packaging. And Baxter cost about the compensation equivalent of a year of a skilled worker, and it costs pennies to operate, as far as electricity, doesn't take vacation, and doesn't have a lot of downtime, let's put it that way. So the labor situation changes, and of course capital, there's all kinds of different means of value. I always jokingly say that if you know the four-digit code, you can walk to an ATM, punch the code in, and you get some money out. But there's no such mechanism for talent, for intellect. There is no way to walk up to a place, a machine or something, and say magic words or punch in some digits and get skilled labor, especially as it comes to cyber, as it comes to the information age. So these are some of the reality of issues that we face. And you know, I see that very clearly economic issues and economic imbalances and economic disparity that exist has something to do with the threats that we face in the cyber environment. So we have no other choice. We have to reduce conflict. We have to do all the things that Michelle was talking about. It's not ideal. It's not the best. It takes more time. It even costs more money. It requires a lot more patience. But we have no choice. We can't just take our means of enforcement and go out there and engage every violator. But it's really important to understand that there is a need to take a fresh look at the rules. The rules as they've been set makes it possible for proxy operations. The rules as they're set makes it possible for denial of actions by state and non-state actors. And we see the examples of this kind of behavior in today's world, not related to cyber, but I don't think it's easy to. Although there's a lot of evidence, but it's not easy to pinpoint the actions of the Islamic Republic of Iran in Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen, Libya, in other places, Syria. They're doing it by proxy. So, and in fact, you know, they have a unit within the Revolutionary Guard that's dedicated to electronic warfare and cyber, extremely active. So I see more of such nefarious activities. And sometimes the interests are so well entrenched that no principle can trump those interests. So no matter how much we try and convince individuals, entities, state, non-state actors about the benefits of not being a nefarious actor,
no matter what, there is a point of an existential risk to their very being the way they are that will not make it possible. So I say this because there is a need to also bring in other elements and not forget that it's important to have that. We can't rely on just, you know, electronic means of securing our networks, as I see the weapon systems of the future, or using diplomacy alone, or even using development alone. Because what we don't want to get into is a situation where we sit and negotiate with various characters about, okay, how much do I have to pay you so that you don't attack my network every other hour? We don't want to get there because, unfortunately, I see that as a very, very high possibility because at the end of the day, that's the reality. It's cyber environment has made it cheap and easy to take the ones who do better hostage and ask for, you know, some balance there. So I'll stop there and look forward to answering questions.
Very good. Thank you. We've heard about diplomacy using the UN Charter, NORAMs. You've heard many speakers this afternoon about how the military is preparing to defend our networks and help defend our nation, and a good discussion on measures. I would like to pose to our panel members, what role does the private sector have? I mean, many times the private sector is broken into two groups. It's either protecting its own intellectual property, critical infrastructure, as Michelle said, they own 90% of the critical infrastructure in this country, or they're in the business of developing technical tools. But looking beyond the technical tools and assuming that the government can't do all things in the cyberspace, what role does the private sector have to move beyond just a point solution or a situation where when we have a new attack vector, it's a reactive, it's more of a proactive response? Anyone?
I'll take a shot at that. You know, when we talk about private sector, essentially we are talking a business framework where the sacred principles of business are the rock and roll, rock being return on capital and roll being return on equity. So that's the focus, the responsibility of businesses to their shareholders and to their employees and to the continuity of the enterprise that they promote. So I'll just jump directly to private business responsibility and infrastructure. You know, a very, very significant portion of our critical infrastructure is owned actually by private sector. And it's a regulated industry by government. But the lines are blurry as to exactly who is responsible for protection of the infrastructure. Pressure on return on capital and other issues stop businesses from extending the resources to be able to even put in affordable remedies that can reduce the risk. But some businesses are hesitant to do that. Why? Because it presents a moral hazard. They're not sure if they start doing that where it would end, where that practice would take them. So I think this is a challenge. I believe there needs to be a dialogue that better educate the interdependence of large businesses, small businesses, government, even the nonprofits, and international institutions. It all has to come together in a way of partnership to be able to have a shared responsibility in doing this. If we do a burden shift of simply saying, well, you know, private sector, you have more capital, why don't you just fix this? Why don't you build the shields and put in the protective measures? It may take a long time to convince, unless we make a huge change in our system and make things mandatory and bring in more regulations, which everyone knows we don't need more regulations. It's really a need for education as to what the role of private sector is. I think it all comes down to cooperation and incentives for cooperation. There has to be a business incentive, and there are plenty. There are plenty. We could. It's not so difficult to be able to explain to private sector that this must be a public-private partnership. And I have no doubt that the contribution of the government to that public-private partnership may not be in terms of financial resources, which is, you know, we're always under pressure, but the intellectual contribution of government to that public-private partnership is extremely significant and valuable, to the point that I don't believe the private sector is capable of getting that kind of experience. I'm told that on a daily basis, our various labs within the military and our defense establishment files on average 2 patents a day on technology. And none of these are not, you know, a lot of them are not commercialized. They don't come out and get commercialized. So one of the activities that could take place is for a mechanism to be able to harvest all of this innovation that is dormant. It gets patented, it sits on the shelf, it goes nowhere. And I'm not sure, maybe there's nuggets of amazing protection right there, some of these that have to be explored. So,
thank you. Michelle?
In my experience, which isn't usually, well, too much direct engagement with the private sector, but some, my view is that they have a huge responsibility both toward their clients and consumers, but they have a very little coherence in their orientation toward public policy. That is, they all have a variety, but a general consistency among their needs. That is, they need, you know, in the international arena, they need access to markets, they need level playing fields. These are issues we're having with China now. But rather than joining together to take on a coherent strategic view about what needs to be done, they tend to represent their own pecuniary interests and therefore weaken their general position. Similarly, they tend to look more and more, I think, for the federal government to do the protection, even though they are now held to a higher standard in terms of their own investors, in terms of what they have to do. So I think even though you have some organizations or associations trying to represent their interests, you find when you push on them at all, they all scatter and represent their own interests. So I think that we need to get beyond that, especially in the international arena, but also with respect to defense and obligation toward consumers.
I agree with you 100%. A quick point on that is that I recognize that, and that's where I believe there is a need to take an objective and fresh look at the rules. Because we refer back to the rules. The rules I just mentioned, the return on equity, return on capital, these are rules that mostly apply to a time past. Just like you said, today, with better education, we expect the investor to demand from the managers and operators of a business to shield against those unthinkable losses, because that's protection of capital, that's protection of their business, and they do carry that responsibility. But having said that, it's also important to realize that businesses are, I mean, the way that happens is mostly through regulation. And when regulation is added on, we had a conversation, Gallup went out and asked there are just 600,000 individuals who can create a job. And the question was asked, a representative sample, why don't you create more jobs? They said, well, we don't get up every day to go create jobs. We get up every day to go look for a customer. And so why don't you look for more customers? So every time I get another customer, I'm hit with another regulation. So regulation is not the way to go about doing this. Education is, I believe, if a good education, and that's where diplomacy and defense can come in to really show the picture of what can happen, because the cost of failure to protect far exceeds the investment required to take the shields and put them in place.
Colonel Bricky.
Well, obviously I'm not in business, but what I'd like to see is that there be some threat sharing. I expect businesses or the private sector to share threat information. What it comes down to is, do we want to compel them? Do we want more regulation? Because then they'll lose competitive advantage, and we're putting a burden on them that maybe other markets or companies from other countries, for example, may not have. The bigger picture, so for bigger companies, they have boards and they have regulation that affects a lot of them, especially with their financial sector. But to me, it comes down to a public service. Now, right now, if someone's under attack, they call the police. There's emergency medical services. There are roads that are maintained. Depending on where you live, they're better than other places. But there is no public service for cyber. And so who's going to protect? You know, small businesses will cease to exist if they have to spend the money that they're expected to spend to protect their customers and to protect themselves. So it's a huge challenge that, often gets overlooked, because when we talk about private sector, a lot of times we're talking about big businesses that can do these things. So.
All right, thank you. One more question, and I'll hand over to the audience. In the State Department, we have a global presence. And we want to leverage the private sector as much as possible. And in IT, as we move to the cloud, geography becomes less and less relevant, which is nice for holding down cost and providing services worldwide. But a thorny continuing problem is data sovereignty. You have to be able to balance the needs of law enforcement in different countries, balanced with where the data centers of these private sector organizations host the data. And for many customers, be it private or public, you may not actually know what country your data may be stored in, especially if it's an email that gets shared two or three times. It may be scattered to the wind, if you would. So I'd like to hear from the panelists real quick. What's your views on using norms, international laws, rules? The military has this problem with this worldwide presence. What do you think about data sovereignty issues? Go ahead.
This is the complexity. This is really most complex issues come, because the kind of countries that come to our minds are countries we have no trouble sitting down, just like Michelle was saying. You know, we have a large number of countries respect the United Nations Charter and its current structure and so forth, and there isn't a challenge on sitting down and agreeing on a protocol. I'm not saying that happens overnight, but I can be convinced that this is a complex issue that can take place within some reasonable time with those actors, with those countries. The world is also moving in a direction where sovereign powers don't have full control over actors that may exist. And it gets even another layer of complexity comes in. It's hard to recognize whether the states have power over those forces or not. It becomes difficult to pinpoint. Some states say, for example, there are certain countries that I have talked to in my previous roles as a public servant, when I ask questions about privacy and intellectual property rights, this one very high-ranking official of another country said to me, well, you're absolutely right. We should develop a 25-year perspective to protect your technology. And I jokingly said to him, we need to develop a 100-year perspective to give you our technology. So that's the reality. That's a reality that takes place out there. And that's where the economic inequalities, because some of those countries happen to be the ones who have demands for prosperity without commitment to change. They don't understand our ways, that one of the reasons that we have sustainable prosperity is because of our system of government. This is how we do it. Now, we're not going to tell you to be just like us, but if you want prosperity, the recipe that we have figured it out works like this. There's a big problem to get them to leave their ways. And, you know, in the past, we've had this commitment to stability. Well, I've been told stability is defined as having the same thing, but more of it next day. And if you have a problem and you have stability, what it means is you have a persistent problem that gets worse with the stability. So I think there's a need for us to shift our thinking along these lines and attend to, again, some economic realities. It's easy to agree with those who think like us, but it's not so easy to get others to agree to norms.
Thank you. Michelle?
So from my perspective, while there was concern about the issue of where data resided in the cloud, it really didn't come to a head until Snowden. And what the Snowden revelations spurred was a trend by some states toward data localization. So states requiring that the data be guaranteed to stay within the borders of their own country. And if that couldn't be guaranteed, then a move toward domestic providers exclusively and away from multinational providers. So what the Snowden effect has had is, for example, in China and Russia, a move toward entirely domestic providers, which is a big problem, and to a certain extent, Russia too, although they haven't locked out U.S. industry yet. So data localization for China and Russia is not done. Snowden is an excuse, basically, because what data localization does is give them the ability to mine that domestic data better and to impinge on the privacy, such as it is, of Chinese and Russian citizens. And that's true in some other countries as well who are going toward data localization, although some less developed countries cannot afford to do that.
Right. Thank you. Colonel Bricky?
Just really briefly, it just makes operations much more difficult, and even more important, they have a good cyber attorney next to you. So.
Well said. I'd like to open the questions up to the audience. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, I'm Jurgen Stupik. I'm with ML Strategies. I'm here on behalf of a client of ours. They're a leading vendor of IT certifications to the federal government. This was a great panel, but I do have two questions. The first, which I think any of you can address, is NIST recently put out a draft report outlining a strategy for U.S. strategic engagement on international cybersecurity standardization, and that draft report is actually open for public comment through next week. I'm just wondering if maybe you can each identify key issues you see as part of that strategy and how you think state DOD and the private sector can participate in that process. My second question is related to credentialing of the federal cyber workforce. We know the Department of State is incentivizing its employees to get certified through the Skills Incentive Program, which, if you're not familiar, allows State Department employees to get a salary increase if they have certain certifications. However, in this environment where we see an increasing number of cyber threats, I was just curious if state is giving any consideration towards moving towards more of a requirement, similar to the way that DOD is requiring all of its employees with information assurance responsibilities to be certified.
Okay. I think you would answer that question.
I'll answer the second one. Don't forget the first one. Yes, state has a skills incentive program, which has been very well received, both for the Foreign Service and the Civil Service employees, with a list of certificates, and the certificate's good for 3 years. They can get additional bonus pay on top of their base pay. In regard to cybersecurity, let's just say that it really is a buyer's market. I'm finding right now that the private sector is having no trouble doubling the salaries, including the skills incentive pay. I've probably lost my four best technical people to the private sector in the last 6 months. While I miss them, I'm a little bit jealous, but they landed on their feet, and we will continue the skill incentive pay, but right now it appears to be basically a speed bump when it comes to trying to retain the talent, because there's just a severe shortage of really talented cybersecurity people, and the private sector is really hungry right now.
I'm no expert on NIST or the new NIST framework. All I've heard, and this is simply hearsay, is that several countries have come forward and have given positive reviews, but I don't know much more than that. So.
I'll have to pass on the first one. I'm not aware of that initiative, NIST initiative. On the there is a DoD Cyber Workforce Strategy document out there. I think it's finalized now, and there are DoD instructions and such for the military or within DoD. I know a few initiatives. First of all, there's DoD is looking at implementing a new career field for civilians. I think the current one for IT specialists is like 2210, I believe is the number. Mm-hmm. They're looking at a new one. The services have different approaches to how they're doing this. And the Army, for example, we just stood up a new branch. I think we're the only service that has a dedicated branch for cyber. But we anybody involved in the cyber mission force that we talked about in the earlier panels, approximately 6,200 people, 133 teams, that's a joint standard, and they have a joint certification process. You have to go through and be certified to do those, to do operations as part of the CMF.
Okay. When I hear certification, you know, two things come to my mind. One is things like NIAP process, and the other one is individual certification for practices and for policy compliance and so forth. In both areas, I believe, my perspective, from a very narrow perspective of private sector, the look back a little bit to my public service days, I see a need to recognize that in both areas, individual certification for education and system certification, we need to recognize the need to pick up speed. What would help is in the individual certification in education that you mentioned about incentives built in to get rewards for that. That's good, but if the process is so cumbersome, I spent 4.5 hours the other day getting myself, you know, the test that I have to take. I did it because I had to, but I wish there was a way for me to do it in an hour, and I wish there was a way for me to do it over a period of time, not worried about time running out on the system. When it comes to those other certifications, I believe it may be helpful to us to recognize the need for expediting the process, perhaps by defining what the requirements are. I'm not an expert in this area, but I would say I'm not sure if there is needed transparency and clear definition of requirements. It's like an Agatha Christie novel. It's just come to me, tell me what you have, and I'll tell you what you need to do, but not all of it. Tomorrow I'll give you some more, and in 6 months you make some progress there. I'm exaggerating, but I believe there is work to be done along those very lines that you mentioned, ma'am.
I have one alibi.
Go ahead.
Or just real quickly. So the Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff just retired, Admiral Winnefeld. Before he left, he put out a draft, and now it's going through the staffing process. But there's a DoD cyber compliance initiative that's going around, and within that, they're going to need to specify specifically, you know, your cyber operators, I mentioned, the CMF, the Cyber Mission Force folks. But then you have your providers, so the IT type of folks. We're going to ask them to do a lot more in the future. you know, more inspections, more checklists and such, but we also have to make sure that we give them the certifications and the training that they need, and that's going to be specified. But that's just probably going to hopefully be signed in the next month at the chairman's level.
And there is a
program. Just real quickly on that point, I believe, you know, the world is moving a lot. When we say cyber, it's not big computers in very cold places. It's about mobility. It's about these devices. And cyber here, this is a soft underbelly of the cyber environment. And solutions when it comes to these have to be expedited. This is where the greatest vulnerability exists in our mobile devices. And again, I'm not being just impatient. I'm thinking about how much time do we really have, recognizing that, you know, those who want to take advantage of our vulnerability work a lot faster than we do.
I will put in a plug for a program called Scholarship for Service. Yeah. It has worked very well for DOD and the civilian side of the government. We attract people still in college working on computer science degrees. And for a requirement for two-year service as civil service, a lot of their tuition can be paid by the government. We get them quickly trained, get them in, they've got fresh skills. Inevitably, we lose a lot of them to the private sector, but we don't lose them all. And that program has been well received throughout the federal space. Yes, sir.
Steve Winters, an independent researcher. I'd like to ask the panel if they could comment on this sort of unfortunate situation in terms of agreements which has arisen in regard to the Wassenaar Agreement, which has created tremendous discouragement among the professional crypto community, and now papers are not being published which were previously scheduled for publication. Hewlett-Packard pulled out of one of their hackathons, which they previously been very active in, so forth and so on. The feeling is the good guys have been very discouraged by this. And how did this mess arise? I mean, I've heard various theories, but I'd like your thoughts on it.
Go ahead.
Well, for one, my perspective is that it's not a mess. Two, it arose from both a French and a British paper 3 years ago, which proposed not so much limiting, but knowing and having the ability to monitor, which Wassenaar does, export controls on certain technologies. What has happened was that a draft rule was put out for which comments were given, and it is comments like yours which were the most. And the fear is that the draft rule was written in such a way that it penalizes the good guys, that is, the researchers and others who are trying to develop defensive techniques. My answer is that it's, you know, the responses to the draft rule are being compiled and reviewed. It is, I think, our view that there are certain valid comments, and there are also certain grave misunderstandings about what the draft rule is intended to cover, and maybe that's the problem of the draft rule, or maybe how it's being interpreted. In any event, those comments will be taken into account. But we have also a countervailing imperative, I believe, and that countervailing imperative is to limit the spread of technology which to non-state and state actors that will use it in nefarious ways. And many of the types of technologies that's used for penetration testing and other types of things can be turned around and used for offensive purposes. And there have been several instances in which a U.S. licensed technology has been used, turned around and used against U.S. networks. So I think that as we go forward, we have to try to balance the interests on both sides. But it is very clear to me, at looking at the international landscape, that there will be pressure from developed states to begin to try to discriminate and figure out ways to incentivize vendors to develop technologies that can be used purposefully for testing defenses without being so useful to offenders and those who would like to use it for malicious purposes. I am not an engineer or a technologist, and I can't tell you a lot more than that, but I sit in that office and have been involved in the debate over how we do this. And I would note in that recent UNGGE report, there was a unanimous call for non-proliferation of malicious technologies to bad places. And just in, as the case in biological weapons or chemical weapons or anything else, there has to be a balance here between the private sector needs and desires and our own defensive needs and the need to limit bad things coming back to haunt us. So I hope that was helpful.
It's after 5 o'clock. I appreciate your attendance. I'd like to thank the panelists, and have a good afternoon.